All of this bonding sounded important, vital, and, well, pretty nice. Attending this huge academic conference for writers called AWP sounded great too, but between childcare and travel costs, I couldn't afford to go, and they didn't offer scholarships or stipends. For similar reasons, things like writing residencies and specific week-long intensive workshops also weren't on my radar. It was only later that I found out I'd gotten it all backward. The connections you made weren't a side benefit of an MFA, they were the primary goal. If someone had sat me down and explained this to me, if they told me that the real opportunity was not in the extra workshops, feedback on your work in progress, or training in teaching via your own composition 101 class, I wouldn't have tried. Honestly, none of that networking, which felt so smarmy, fake, and creepily transactional, really interested me, especially since most of the time those conversations were with privileged people. I really just wanted to learn how to make it as a writer from writers who supposedly already had made it in some way.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome to episode 601 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I speak to the best-selling writer, Stephanie Land, about her newest book, Class, a Memoir of Motherhood, Hunger, and Higher Education. Congrats to her on the publication of Class earlier this week. Here in Central Florida, at the secret headquarters of the Drunken Odyssey, there's so much going on. Starting this Sunday, Miami Book Fair kicks off 8 days of Miami Book Fairing, with a week of special events culminating in what appears to be 3 days of the street fair. If you live in South or even Central Florida and love books, you owe it yourself to take a look. I'm planning to take the secret headquarters down there next weekend, which reminds me that I need to schedule next week's episode, in which I interview Walter Mosley early. Next month, I begin a book tour of my own for a book that is just a poetry collection in progress called In Buzo Veritas. This tour will feature short appearances, often paired up with other literary activities. The goal is for me to test these poems before audiences in an entertaining mode, somewhere between stand-up comedy and Charles Bukowski, but without the screaming and sloppy drunkenness. I may even have a drink or two for old time's sake. On Saturday, December 9th, from noon to 3 p.m., Nick Gergidiou and I will host a type-in at the Kerouac Project of Orlando. If you live in Central Florida and would like the chance to write in a historic location where Jack Kerouac wrote the first draft, Scroll, of the Dharma Bums, the house will be open to the public and filled with typewriters. I love watching people try out these machines Nick so generously shares for these events. Everyone is afraid, then curious. Then they bite their lip and get to work. In terms of writing I may have done since last we spoke, I think I've solved a problem in terms of bridging the first and second acts of my horror screenplay. But, you know, I need to do that thing where I type on the keys. I have made progress on an essay about fountain pens that I am writing using fountain pens. And not that I need to carry water from Marvel Entertainment, but I finished watching season 2 of Loki, which I hope will be its last, not because I thought it was bad, but because it feels complete and moved me, though I'm not sure I think it is good storytelling. I'm just not sure. Frankly, any spectacle that features design ripped from the early 1970s, I might be a sucker for. Normally, I hate time travel stories and narratives that attempt Mobius loops and metaphysical wit, and I suspect the physics here doesn't make great sense. But I love watching great characters grapple with unsolvable problems, kind of like my life. Stephanie Land's writing, both in Maid and Class, moved me. The work is both grounded and heartbreaking and smart and makes my own life more visible to me while making other people's lives more visible to me at the same time. This is what writing is for. Let's talk to Stephanie.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today is Stephanie Land, who is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Maid, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and many other outlets. Her writing focuses on social and economic justice and parenting under the poverty line. Her latest book, Class, A Memoir of Motherhood, Hunger, and Higher Education, has just come out, and it's a great honor to be talking to Stephanie Land. Stephanie, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to talk to you as well.
So I think I've kind of had you living in my head for a while because I somehow missed the Maid phenomenon. And then I was shocked because this podcast has been around for a while and it was a Netflix show. And somehow that passed me by as well. And yeah, when I found out about the new book, I'm like, well, let me check out Maid. And then I'm like, where the fuck was I? Because this is one of those books that really speaks to me. So I grew up in a blue collar household, first person to go to college, and I've turned into this academic monster, but yet I somehow never quite fit the right demographic for the academic world. But I've also made myself not normal for any other world either. And nevertheless, the hunger for learning and the love of writing that comes through in your books really speaks to me. So after Maid was a success, and I imagine a lot of Class was written kind of while you were working on getting that book out, you had a lot more to say. So could you talk a little bit about this project and what made you want to keep talking about these topics as you sort of phased out of being a maid and focused? You became a full-fledged college student and really devoted yourself to writing. That's a lot of topics thrown with a question mark casually thrown in at the end. Any part of it you like.
Well, the book Maid it came to fruition because I had an essay go viral. And what was fun in Class was I got to write about writing that essay and creating that essay and what it was like to write that essay in college in a workshop where I was in there with a bunch of kids, you know, that were much younger than me. And that was just me writing about my life, but it was so different from everybody else's that it was almost kind of embarrassing to reveal what my life was like outside of class. So the essay that I started in that classroom was the one that went viral, and it was actually the one that I used for my MFA application and was rejected, and then went on to be this book called Maid. And when the essay went viral, my former agent had reached out to me and asked me if I was working on a book, and I just kind of...
The answer was always yes.
Said yes. Yeah. I mean, I said yeah, even though I wasn't really. And so he asked me to send him a few chapters, and I wrote some down and sent them to him. And the story that I had proposed writing was very different from the one that became Maid. The story was the book Class, because to me, that's the most interesting part about my story. I didn't really think cleaning houses was all that interesting. But the part where I got out of this very toxic environment and moved us to a supportive community and went on to go to college and graduate and become a writer. But that happened a little bit later. But that's the part to me that I was most proud of and that I wanted to write about. I don't know how many times I've said it takes a Netflix series, but in order for me to write this second memoir that's kind of the sequel and the origin story of the first book, I had to garner a much bigger platform and some more clout or some more success in order to get the stamp of approval for a sequel memoir, which not a lot of writers get to do.
Well, and I imagine there's just frustration and confusion where having to write in a hurry because you don't have time. And so you're writing about what your life has been like or what your life is like. And because it's so under the poverty line and just working so hard, doing things that almost no one in a university, other than the people who work at night at a university, will understand, you're blurting out your truth. Not a profound truth, just this is what it's like. And I don't mean to undersell MADE, because I do think it's profound in the way that you understood your clients and the way that you understood your relationship with clients. And in some ways, it's almost like being a spy, even though that's not your job, but you can't clean a house over and over again and not learn things. But to get back to my other point, which is your prosaic truth that you didn't work that hard at seems so exotic that you seem like a creative genius to people who don't understand how someone could come up with that. And it's like, because that's my fucking life.
Yeah. In the process of editing MADE, I had to go back, and I actually went back and read Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich. I had read that pretty soon after it came out, like in my very early 20s. And at the time, it was just kind of like, yeah, so what? So she's working at the jobs that I work at. It wasn't that big a deal. But when I went back and read it the second time, as I was just trying to work on this book about my life, I realized that the whole entire book was about her search for secure housing. And I kind of forgot that not everyone experiences that. And so the parts that were added to MADE, and a lot of what I tried to really flush out in class, was that day-to-day stuff that to me was explaining how I made my peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But to other people, it's like, whoa, you had to do this? You had to think about this all the time? Because people who live in poverty are constantly doing mental math. It's a joke when people say that they need to budget better. I budgeted way better when I didn't have any money than I do now, because I knew exactly what I needed. I knew how much it cost. I knew what section of the grocery store it was in. I knew when it was going to go on sale. And just so that part, I think, are the things that people make a lot of assumptions about people who live in poverty, but they are very cognitively affected by the stress that they are under, the financial stress, but they are also thinking and planning and doing all this financial stuff in their head, but it's just to get through the day or the end of the week. And so I really just wanted to show what that stress feels like. Because I think that one of the things that the Netflix series did very well was people felt stressed watching it. And I loved hearing about that. So I was like, good, that's what it's supposed to do. And so I kind of wanted to create that in the book, in class too, of just bringing people into this world of you always need to get going. You need to be somewhere. You need to get to work. You need to get somewhere with this small child who's refusing to put on their shoes and trying not to cuss at them, and then get out the door and get to work so you can pay your rent that month.
And you say you have to do mental math, but it's almost like in order to deal with all the bureaucratic arms of all the services that you're trying to get to help you, there's labor involved in just applying for these programs and having to learn the system that either through negligence or design, and I'm guessing it's both, are meant to make people miserable and give up and not try.
Yes.
On the one hand, it's like, well, if you need it, then you will do it because you have no other choice. And I'm like, well, that's up until a point, I think that's almost legitimate, but at every turn, so that the bureaucracy lives in your head, because you have to become almost your own bureaucratic wing of the government to advocate for yourself so that you're not homeless or starved to death while you're working as hard as you can and picking up every job that you can, to the point when your whole body is shutting down because you are pushing it beyond its boundaries. And then someone at the supermarket goes, you're welcome, when you use food stamps or whatever the current terminology is, thinking, yes, they paid their taxes, partly so that you wouldn't be homeless and so that you'd only be hungry but not starve.
Yes.
And they just paid their taxes, and you had to do so many things just to get in a position to not starve. And then they want you to grovel at the supermarket.
Yeah, very Oliver Twist scenario. And I kind of felt that way as a writer who was trying to pull people into that world and show people what it was like. When I was writing MADE, I felt very apologetic for being poor And I felt very apologetic just in writing the story. And with class,
you found your anger.
I very much tried to be angry. And that was very purposeful. I'm curious how people are going to react to it. I think for me, it's probably kind of fun because I can tell a lot about a person by the things that they nitpick in my books and the things that they don't like about it. There's people who think I give my kid too much ice cream, and that's ridiculous. Why doesn't my kid deserve ice cream? And so, like, I have some ability in this book to be angry and to call out things that are ridiculous. I think because I have more distance from it, because I am more successful this time around. And so I do have a little bit of that untouchable type of thing going on, but I'm still a human being. So it still does get to me. But I think there is a lot of misconception about government assistance programs. And outside of my work in writing books, I have worked as, I could describe it as tireless, but I am very tired, the advocate and public speaker, and traveling around to talk to organizations and to support them in their fundraisers. And so this has kind of been my life for not just living it, but also beyond that, and trying to use writing as a way to pull people in so that they can experience what it's like. And while doing that, hopefully opening up doors for other people to write about their experience, because I am still a very privileged version of that experience.
So let me go on the record to say that this isn't a very angry book, but there's some anger in it that to me feels completely justified. And I want to go to the Maya Angelou quote. The inspirational ones, they're fine. But when she said, when people show you who they are, believe them. Because if anyone reads the book and go, she's too angry, I'm like, oh, you don't think women are allowed to be angry, period. If that's the judgment, that's my retort is, oh, you don't think women are allowed to be angry, period. Which, how could a woman not be angry if that's a mirror she's facing in another human being is, oh, you're not allowed to be angry ever under any circumstances.
Yeah, I got asked that question a lot over the last few years of, but weren't you angry? And so when I sat down to write this book, I wrote this book fucking fast in like 30 days. But when I sat down to write it, I realized I wasn't angry. I didn't have time to be angry. Yeah. What's the use in doing any of that? That, where is that going to get me? And so I wanted to kind of honor that version of myself. And I was pissed off for her.
Yeah, anger is something you could, it's a luxury for someone who gets to have a civilized life.
Yeah, the anger itself would just create more problems for me in that situation. Mm-hmm. If I'm angry, then I would get pushed out the door and I would get even less opportunities for resources because I was a problem or difficult or whatever. And so I really wanted to show that that is part of the resilience training that marginalized people are forced into. And a lot of that is just forced acceptance and without complaint.
Having to beg for visibility.
Yeah, and value and dignity and worth. And so you're already begging for so much more in your life that should be a human right. It's a basic need. But then when you are asking people for help, you kind of have to prove yourself over and over again that you're worth it. And you mentioned bureaucracy living in my head. It still affects me daily. I've been kind of surprised over the last few years of just how much I find value internally by the work that I'm able to do and produce. And if I'm not working, then I don't really feel that I have a lot of value at all. And so it's been interesting to identify when that comes up.
Have you seen The Incredibles?
The first one?
Yeah,
yeah.
The first one. I expect that was a question you expected to be asked today. I remember when I saw it, I thought it was forgettable. It was adequate. Okay, what's wrong with it? There's not much wrong with it. But there's a moment before Bob sneaks back to being a hero secretly when he's working at the insurance agency and he gets so mad that he tells the old woman how to get her claim approved. And his boss yells at him and he goes, they're penetrating the bureaucracy, Bob. And then I laugh so hard that I think I scared everyone in the audience because that 10 seconds of the movie redeemed the whole movie for me, even though you could throw that out. The plot doesn't change. probably. It maybe suggests why Bob is willing to do something so risky and sketchy to try and create value. But in the corporate world, no, preventing people from getting their claims approved was the reason the insurance company existed, so that it would generate profit. And that was what he was facing every day, which is meaningless. He was living early stages of existential life. And I just think that a story like Made, it's like, okay, you took the important moment from The Incredibles and then made that the focus. And The Incredibles, I'm a Disney fan, I'm a Pixar fan. It's not bad, but ultimately, I don't think it matters that much other than that one scene. Does that resonate at all?
Yeah. I thought you were going to talk about when she was like checking out her butt in the mirror or something, because you mentioned the mirror earlier. No, I have researched and done deep dives, and I've made close friends with people who have extensively reported on the fraud that happens within the TANF program. And I'm not talking about fraud that the people who need it are doing. It's the people who supply it. And
what is TANF? What does that stand for?
TANF is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Mm-hmm. It's what people think of as welfare. It's cash assistance. And the program itself is so impossible that most people at the state office will tell you to not apply. But what happens is states will get a block grant. And if they don't use all of that money, then they can use it somewhere else, wherever they want. And so what TANF has become is this a maze of paperwork, required workshops, classes. The paperwork is intense. And it's all for, I think, the times that I've looked into it, I would either break even because I have to hand over my child support money in order to even be mm-hmm. on this program.
You could
or
lose money.
I would essentially lose money and time and energy and all of that. And that to me is the attitude of every government assistance program, because the less people who sign up, the more state representatives can say they're working because people aren't utilizing it. And that can easily be translated into we're doing better. Everything's good. Less people are on food stamps. Yay. But then the harder they make it, the less likely people are to want it. And so they won't even try. And so those block grants can go to other places. And I just think it's so backwards, especially when it's for children. I would not be surprised if Manchin started requiring some kind of work requirement for kids getting school lunches. It gets that ridiculous.
Oh, the coal's not going to come out of the mountain by itself. What are the kids
yeah.
doing?
Exactly. I don't understand. There are many things that baffle me about the way that the people who are supposed to take care of us talk about poor people in our country. But when they're talking about children, I just don't understand. It's just incomprehensible to me. It blows my mind.
Well, there are mind-blowing moments in your book where people say things and my brain goes, and people have said this to me about my nonfiction on occasion where they're like, oh, that's not credible. And I'm like, no, this is nonfiction. That happened. I don't think my situations weren't as dire as yours. The stakes were lower. I just had my heart broken is all. And I don't mean that sarcastically or ironically, because it really wasn't my safety or sanity that was at stake. But to go back to that line, people show you who they are, believe them. When you are a deeply vulnerable member of society, some of the things that people say and do to those people are just truly shocking. I think of your client who claimed you were an inferior maid and therefore had to terminate your contract because she couldn't afford to live up to her end of the contract. But instead of having, admittedly, okay, a legally risky heart-to-heart going, look, this is not fair, we have to break the contract. And instead of trusting in your humanity, she just fucked you over as a human being
and
left you to wonder, how can I work harder to make this right? When it's like, no, this was never about making it right.
Yeah, but it's so easy for people to take advantage of people who are desperate and to not just exploit them, but to not pay them very well. Or that was one thing that I really struggled with being a house cleaner, was I was not a necessity in their home. For some people I was, but for most of I was the treat yourself, and I was the extra help around the holidays or something that if it can fit in the budget that month. And that was my lifeline. And suddenly if I missed a day of work to them, it's like, oh, I'll just cancel. I'm too tired to deal with this. For me, it's like, suddenly I can't pay rent. And I'm not going to tell them that. I don't want to make them feel bad or anything. I don't really want people to know how close to this line of homelessness that I'm kind of avoiding on a daily basis, but because I don't want people to be concerned about my child. So there's just kind of this constant worry of being incredibly disappointed and still trying to show that none of that is going on.
While always trying to be a good mom, which in essence means trying to be a good leader for your family, which means, okay, you're in charge of morale no matter what.
Yeah, I didn't always do a great job at that, but I did my best.
It sounds like you didn't do a terrible job at that. I'm sure as the mom, you could think of the bad moments where you're like, all right, like, no, that was him yelling. But I'm sure there were a lot of moments where like, okay, you just kind of screw on a grin and do what has to be done and then kind of collapse later in quasi-private.
Yeah, since I'm going to write about it for thousands of people later on. Yeah, Story, Amelia goes by Story now. It was kind of us against the world for a long time. And now we've had so much distance from that time period that we're kind of nostalgic about it. And all of those really hard times, they've got some glitter to them over the years. And it was incredibly hard, but it was also very deeply connected and very personal between the two of us. And something that I went through with this other human who was very small at the time, but it was still just this, we absolutely had to be a team all the time. And it was mostly up to me to always make that work, which was incredibly exhausting because she is the smartest person I know. And she has been that way since before she was born, probably. And so I had to be two steps in front of her all the time. And that to me was the most exhausting part, I think, is just anticipating what her reaction was going to be to seeing something in a store or anything.
So class covers your time in college, learning about writing and kind of, I don't want to say exactly a horror show, but learning about the culture of writing in ways that sometimes were great, but often were not. And this is a topic that I feel very conflicted about. My MFA, it was literary fantasy camp, and it happened in my mid-30s, but after a PhD, I didn't have a child. And so I struggled economically while earning my MFA, unlike some of my peers who had very posh jobs or, let's say, secure jobs that kept them securely in Manhattan or in Brooklyn. And I was insecurely in Brooklyn for 3 years. But I knew this is literary fantasy camp. This is just ridiculous. And I got to enjoy it like a weekend at Disneyland, except it was 3 years in this writing program. And I think I got to it at the exact time when I knew how to make something like the most of it, which I'm really grateful for. Because if I'd gotten there in my mid-20s, I would have learned so little. I would have just been occupying space as an asshole, frankly. And it seems like you had a much more stressful experience, but a similar experience in that a little bit older, I think you knew the value of getting your undergrad degree in writing and getting to study at the school you really had been pining for years. And then you got to have that experience. And it probably felt really sweet some of the time. There was years I didn't think I would get here, but I kept fighting and I'm here. You're getting the writing done that you had hoped that you would get done. Yeah, I guess I just want to share notes about what that experience was like, because when people ask me, should I get an MFA? The answer is always maybe. And then, okay, here's all the caveats and here's how I think your decision tree should go, but don't pay a lot of money and make sure that you get out of it what you hope to get out of it. And don't just go figuring it's an automatic rubber stamp to your dreams, because it can't be that. Whatever it is you're hoping for, that is unlikely to happen unless the light bulbs go off in your mind at the right time and you meet the right teacher who's going to introduce you to their agent, which happens, but that's not normal. Could you talk a little bit about some of the ups and downs? And I realize like that's a lot of what your book class is about, but I got excited reading it. I get flashbacks to my own education, like which is very similar and very different from yours, it sounds like.
I get asked the same question about whether or not someone needs an MFA, and I think they very much want you to think that you do.
For me, the answer is no. No one needs an MFA. Even if you're a writer who lives to write, you don't need an MFA. So the question is, would it help? But no. That one I find easy to answer. No, no one needs an MFA. Even writers who love writing, who live for writing, you don't need it.
Right. Well, I think there are so many artists out there who are clamoring to not just have space to create, but to have space to be seen. And that's what the MFA does, is it promises visibility and to show you how to be visible, but none of it shows you how to make money, even what to do with that money once you have it. The business side of writing is not taught because it's not assumed that that's what people are there for. And through the years after graduating and becoming a freelancer, that was a thing that I had to figure out for myself. And that's the thing that I'm most passionate about teaching now, teaching writers, especially how to get paid for their time.
And you would think that should be the most teachable part, is the business.
Yeah. But it's not. But I mean, people don't even know about different taxes and why it's important to get an LLC, or that there's a thing called a self-employed tag that you can write off your phone, and just all of this stuff. None of that is taught in school. And I think it would be so amazing if it did, some kind of home ec class for writers.
I think that should be built in. Yeah. In my program at NYU, and I think this was because the culture at NYU was changing, they were bringing in agents, not for meetings with students saying, okay, get to work, but rather to get some coaching and to learn a little bit about how do you go get an agent. And so it wasn't exactly like, hey, go hump the leg of that person right there, but rather pitch to that agent and get used to pitching and learn what agents do and how they think and how they work, which leaves out 90 to 99% of what the business is. But at least it was not nothing, because I know a lot of programs, even discussing the money or the business or getting paid is dirty.
Yeah, well, and it's commercial. That is how I'm described, is I'm a very commercial writer. And I kept hearing that tossed around with academics and people who taught me in school. And I finally asked, what do you mean by that? Well, I mean, it's a job. It's how you make money. And I said, well, yeah. Isn't that why we all went there? It doesn't really compute to me that you would go so deeply into debt, unless you're not going deeply into debt, unless it is just what you described it as, a fun summer camp that's paid for. But to me, it was the gateway. It was just a step in learning how to do a job and to have a career. And I don't think that's very common for writers, especially because a lot of the writers who do make it are the ones who are supported in some way. And for me, you know, going in there and being obviously very unsupported writer and just there by my own wit and stubbornness, it was hard for me to, I think, be taken seriously. And I kept finding myself wanting to be more male, honestly, because then it's assumed that I'm eventually going to have someone who's supporting me while I'm doing my job.
All right. I feel dirty hearing that, but I believe that is a built-in expectation in the culture, to be sure.
Which part? The supported writer or the male part?
That the male will be and should be supported in that way. Frankly, that describes some writers I know. If the women are happy, well, then I'm happy. But that expectation, though, does a lot of damage. And that's something I could also visibly see. Because I guess one of the frustrations of my life is I'm a middle-aged white dude, which means I look like the problem. I don't want to say I'm never the problem, but I'm so hungry to hear voices that aren't mine.
Yeah.
That the things that just seem, I kind of look like I should be running things. And it's like, I run the Drunken Odyssey. What does that tell you about running things? Like I'm kind of this rogue ship on a podcast. So I'm kind of my own country here. And so I find injustice somewhere between frustrating and infuriating. But I prefer to be infuriated because it's been made visible to me. To me, that's something that your books do. Not constantly. It's not the teapot's always hissing, but you make so many through narrative. You're telling a story that is a good story that's worth hearing, that really ropes me in, but also it makes so much injustice visible through storytelling, which means you're not a social justice warrior in your storytelling going, you're going to read this because it's good for you. It's like, no, I'm reading this because it's a well-crafted tale with someone who knows what matters. And then there are moments where I'm like, oh, that's just wrong. I don't know. Can we blurb that as a half-assed review of Made Enough?
I'll take it.
I think of, in class, you write about a fuck buddy who becomes a crazy stalker.
He's very angry at me.
in ways which, if the police got involved, would not have been inappropriate for the police to get involved with some of the abusive behavior, or maybe all of it, probably all of it. I think you allow anyone one bad conversation.
Well, yeah, there's probably a scale on that too.
To be sure, yes. I found that both shocking and believable. And this is a community, an environment that they feel very familiar to me. This is the world I live in, and this is the exalted world of academia, not like the real world, which is, if this is what academia looks like, then you refer to the university as a sacred place, and it's like, it is, but even the sacred place has monsters.
Yeah, I'm sure there are many stories about people who have been affected by monsters in academia. It was sacred. I was just on campus a couple of weeks ago, honestly. I go back and I do Montana Writers Live now as a presenter, and it smells the same. Walking into the hall, they still haven't gotten the heating issues corrected. Like, it's the structure will live on. And so that part of it is what's kind of sacred to me, is just the walls and the actual space, and that I was granted access to it felt a little celestial to me, just in this way that I could just sit and be immersed in it. And I didn't really have that in my life anywhere else. So there was a part of it that I still appreciate, having that time. Even if there were some people who were just complete dicks, there were still some people there.
Including some faculty.
There were still faculty, people that I still deeply admire and that I appreciate them continuing to be in my life. And they're still part of my local community, and they're still there fighting the good fight. So it's not all bad.
I'm still an academic creature. I certainly don't mean to go in the opposite direction to say, oh, no, no, if I'm going to hang out someplace, that's where I feel most at home. But I also remember just noting, and I think there's a wonderful scene where you are meeting with a teacher who you were just getting to know or getting to know better. And then you're telling that teacher what other people have said about your prospects and about you applying for the MFA. And the other teacher was saying, she said that, really? Huh. I remember, I think I was a sophomore, and I'm like, not all of these people like each other or even agree about why we're here. And thinking that was an interesting thought to sit on for a while. And I think I've been sitting on it ever since, even when I still believe in the platonic ideal of education. Like, let's just keep talking. Let's keep learning.
Yeah, because I did go back and talk to people and interview. Well, it's not really an interview. It's just kind of helped me jog my memory. And so I did learn some gossip. That was validating. I'll say that.
Learn some stories that maybe explained some things that seemed inexplicable at the time.
Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily about me personally all the time. I wish I had known that at the time, but there were systems in place that were the same as government assistance programs that were designed to keep me out of spaces that might be occupied by someone who is supported and might go on to be successful and bring in funding because look at what they produce. But I was not seen as a person who would do that.
And they were wrong.
Yeah, you know, a big part of the book is
I know it's
giving
a bad look for you to go, yes, but they were wrong.
There is an aspect to this book that I do enjoy giving people the middle finger. And it's a unique opportunity to be able to do that. So I did enjoy that.
Which is what I think Socrates might have done. You clearly love writing. You do write about joy. There's so much hardship. I think that makes the joys that you experience during times of hardship actually mean a lot more. Sometimes there's an almost magical quality to them because you're like, I can't believe something good is happening. I wonder if you could talk about the pleasure of writing, even when having to write about the infuriating injustices that you've experienced or some of the emotionally harrowing experiences that you've had. And yet, if you can't find the joy in the writing, then the writing probably isn't going to get done. Is there a paradox there that you could help explain?
I really have learned to appreciate writing in scene. I don't know if I was really taught that in college. I had to learn what that was through actually doing it in a book. But now that's kind of my favorite part, is because I am so visually minded. And I've learned recently that that's unique, that not everybody can do that. But I kind of have this ability to, I don't even have to close my eyes. I can, in my head, visually put me in that room and look around and see the stack of papers and see the bread that needs to be thrown out and all of this stuff that's going on. And when I'm writing about my daughter and scenes where she's jumping on this trampoline in her underwear and she's got Nutella all over her face. And I never did a baby book or anything like that. But for me, that's fun, is I get to relive this time with her and record it and just talk about how much joy was in that scene for me. So there are parts of writing that I do really enjoy reliving. And it's fun to figure out how to do character building within dialogue and just how people sigh or how people fidget or pick lint off of their pants. There's a lot of stuff that you can do just from things that you notice in real life in day-to-day conversations, but it's not necessarily always in a book that you're reading about. So that's the fun that I have, maybe.
Well, because I say we're taught, I was taught finding the authenticating detail in a scene is really important, because someone says, oh, that makes it feel real. Kind of like a lie has to have a realistic detail that seems so strange that it's like, well, that has to be true because no one would make that up, except, of course, someone who's a really good liar. But in storytelling, you need to find the authenticating detail. But proving that a scene is realistic, it itself isn't special if you pile on a bunch of authenticating details that don't resonate. And so just through practice, you're like, okay, let me find one or two authenticating details that light up the scene without bogging it down and try to keep up the momentum. I think once we leave the apprentice stage of getting used to just doing that, and instead you can sort of take pleasure in writing the thing, knowing how well you're writing the thing while also paying attention to the job of writing the thing. Does that make any sense? That kind of dual vision where you're like the writer and a little bit of the critic at the same time going, wow, I like the way I put that together, but let's keep going.
Well, a writer friend dared me when I set out to write Maid. I'd never written anything more than 20 pages. And my editor wanted a complete manuscript. She didn't want to go chapter by chapter. So I had to write this whole fucking book. And I had no idea how to do that. And so he dared me to just write it from beginning to end and not look back. And that's what I did. And over the years, I've talked about that and how stupid that was. Because then you end up reading your book 10 or 15 times trying to figure out, did I put that in chapter 2? Am I repeating myself? You're like paying friends to hopefully read it and mark if you're using the word little too much. And it's just, it makes the editing process insanity inducing. But I did the same thing with this book because I kept a journal for 30 years. And so I think that is just the way that I go about processing things, is very chronologically and very day-to-day how the story came out and how it happened beginning to end. But there was a part that I just found myself really appreciating in discovering what comes up. And it was usually the things that I remembered the most. And just these, not necessarily things that I was very emotional about, but just things that really stuck out in my mind of just writing it purely from memory. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily going through. And although with class, I went through all of my Facebook posts from that time because I was very prolific on social media because it was kind of my social life. And so I did go through and review. My mind was mush that year for many reasons, but it was mostly because I was pregnant and the workload was so high. But in writing from memory, I think that's a good way to figure out what's going to stick in other people's minds as well. As well, if I still remember this very specific detail about this person 10 years later, then that might be good writing.
So it sounds like you have regrets about that process, but it also sounds like process worked.
I guess. I know my books really well. There's that part to it.
I do believe writing any book that matters, it's not easy. Part of the process will kick your butt at some point.
That is one thing that I really appreciate about college, is I learned how to put my butt in the chair and produce words with so many distractions going on and so much in my life going on, because that's 80% of the job is just sitting down and showing up for work and getting it out of you. So that is one thing that I learned, because I hated that Shakespeare class and I had to write 10 page papers about Shakespeare, and I got through it and I got an A. I think he felt sorry for me though.
I'm guessing the work you were unenthusiastic about nevertheless was smarter and more interesting than a lot of the other papers that teacher had to look at. That is my guess. I've taught Shakespeare classes. I've taught a lot of lit classes. And sometimes the student who maybe doesn't show the most academically precise analysis of something, but seems to get it, or at least is alive on the page, that counts for so much when you're just this grading machine, which I find to be dehumanizing. And when you mentioned the Shakespeare class, I laughed because I thought of the scene in class where you brought your daughter to the class on Macbeth. Turns out she was paying more attention than you thought maybe she would have. And the language is really gross. And as someone who knows a fair amount of Shakespeare, I fucking hate Macbeth. I hate it so much. It's so miserable. I don't care about any of the characters, with the possible exception of the guy who has to open the door for comic relief in the middle of the play. That's the only character I kind of sort of care about. In a production, great actors could make me start to care. But on the page, it's just miserable. And to people who hate Shakespeare who have to spend a lot of time with Macbeth, I totally get it.
Puck is one of my favorite characters ever written. I have a huge tattoo of him on my shoulder.
Shakespeare loved his clowns.
Oh, yeah.
So much love for his clowns.
I love Midsummer Night's Dream. That is something that I've read over and over again over the years. And I think that's why that professor liked me, is because I loved that play and how they just made a mockery of romantic love. And I was very jaded at the time. I still am. So I think the professor kind of, I had a lot of leeway with my test scores because he really appreciated how I did write my papers, probably.
It's now belatedly occurring to me also, I don't think I ever studied Shakespeare in a class. So that for me, Shakespeare was always this marginal thing on the side that just kept growing.
Yeah.
So that I was never on the hook for explaining Shakespeare as a student. Students were on the hook for explaining Shakespeare to me. I hope I didn't do too much damage.
No, it was a required class, and it always met Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the middle of the day, and there's no way around it. I needed to take it to graduate, and there was so much working against that class for me already that just getting there was just the most horrible thing in the world. So I'm sure I was not fun to look at when he was trying to give a lecture.
As an undergrad, we had the option to take Chaucer. I don't know how I ended up making that decision, but I took the Chaucer route. And I remember nothing. All right, I think we got it. Normally when I do formal closures on the show, I feel like a used car salesman, but it's been a delight to talk to you. Do you want me to follow up with you or your publicist when this goes up in November?
Publicist. Everything goes through her, and then it eventually gets to me. Yes, well, thank you very much.
Break a leg on book tour if that's what's happening next. But yes. No, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I felt like I was meeting a kindred spirit reading class, and you did a wonderful job with the audiobook for me.
Oh, thank you. I did the audiobook for class too. So not the greatest experience when you have a bunch of sex scenes, but yeah, I got through it.
You know what? I'm not going to comment on that. I'll just let that go. All right. Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Stephanie Land, Emmy Battaglia, and Isaiah Portillo for editing this episode. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, Heartbreaking Comic Book Reviews by Drew Barth, and of course, reviews of Sublime Cinema by our own curator of schlock, that is, Jeff Schuster. Until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Never mind, John. Pass me the bottle.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.